France, meaning the administration of Macron and their finance department. But the Bank of France has said, you know what, 1% is even too much. It has proposed 0.8%, which is a more realistic projection based on what they have said. Of course, that translates to a lot of money, but still, it's very little compared to the fact that France is one of the biggest economies in the top three of the Eurozone. Next sector of the economy that needs to, a focus on is pensions. And herein lies a problem for Macron and also previous administrations when it comes to deficit reduction. This cannot be achieved without pension reform. That's the bottom line on pensions. And the problem that France has, well, you can see 14% of that, of GDP, that is spent on public pensions. That's a lot, because when you take a look at the OECD average, it's only 8%. So obviously, there is a big problem for France to try to reform that. And finally, when it came to the budget, President Emmanuel Macron's government had to ram its 2023 budget through Parliament. What does that mean? That means it had to do that without a vote, after battling in vain for it to get approved by the fractured lower house of Parliament. That's right. He had to push that through. The loss of his overall majority is the reason for that. That happened in June on the legislative polls, which meant he could not get enough deputies to actually approve the package. Understandably, the opposition was not too happy. Okay, let's bring in, let's bring back Pierre-Emmanuel Thomann, or Thomann, geopolitical analyst, who rejoins us. Pierre-Emmanuel, welcome back. At the same time that Europe is facing a rising populism, you've got sanctions against Russia, obviously to have hurt the livelihoods there in Europe. The public demand for livelihoods will be used by far-right parties, as they have been, in terms of thrusting them into power. Don't you think that that's going to pose a threat to the overall European political system?
I think we are already in a systemic crisis, but for many years this was the case, and it's increasing more and more and accelerates with this Ukraine crisis. Because within the European Union, actually, there are many disagreements between EU member states, more and more, and they are more and more fragmented. And this is why they want so much to appear united, although they are not, and they view the European project in different ways. And first of all, the systemic crisis of the European project, for example, is totally related with a systemic crisis in international relations of a global world order. More and more, there is a multipolarity which is emerging, and the West is defined as the United States and its main allies within NATO, and this group of countries, or governments, I would say, because you know, the population are not that in line with the governments, is part of a systemic crisis as well. These Western countries they don't accept multipolarity, and especially United States and EU and NATO. They want to reduce your acceleration of this multipolarity emerges with Russia, China, Iran, Brazil, South Africa, Saudi Arabia, having much more power on clout and refuse to align themselves on the main power, United States, which was enjoying the unipolar moment, until recently.
Okay, very well. Let me bring back Clive Menzies, political economy researcher and analyst from London, see what he thinks. Clive Menzies, along the same lines about how Europe is facing rising populism, you have these far-right parties and that are now thrust into positions. The public demand for livelihoods will be used by them to basically lead the country economically also. Wouldn't that pose a threat to the overall European political system?
Well, I think it's fair to say, to some extent, these words like populism and far right are manufactured by the media. Essentially, what we've seen over the last 120 years or so is the destruction of the nation state, or the concept of the nation state. And what people are, when people decide that their country should not be ruled by people outside the country, effectively the UN and the EU, then that that is described as populism or far right, whereas in fact a more accurate characterization is people wanting to take power back in order to control their own destinies.
Europe is facing a tough economic time. Inflation in the Eurozone has reached unprecedented levels. The latest data shows that inflation rose an average to 10.9% across the European Union. In August, that figure stood at 10.1%, and the annual inflation rate in the Eurozone was 9.9% in September, a jump from 9.1% in August. In the United Kingdom, the latest figures show that inflation hit 10.1% in September. The figure matches a 40-year high that was hit in July. The rising prices have pushed the European Commission to propose a 40 billion euro in aid to help small and medium-sized firms. High prices are also adding urgency for more rate hikes by the European Central Bank. Europe is now facing an energy crisis. According to authorities in Italy, electricity tariffs saw record growth last month, exceeding 136% on an annual basis. Rising energy costs have also pushed authorities in Germany to a 200 billion euro plan to combat the energy crisis.
We know that Europe's energy demand is very large, so it is logical that instead of outbidding each other, the member states and the energy companies should leverage their joint purchasing power. And for that, we propose today legal tools for pooling energy demand at European level.
That package includes relief measures like a gas price cap and a tax on windfall profits made by energy firms. The unprecedented crisis has now triggered concerns over the economic future of the Eurozone. It is now believed that the rising of far-right parties will cause further frictions and rivalries between EU states.
When it comes to the economies of Europe, there is a misunderstanding that their turmoil is due to the Ukraine conflict. But that is a misconception, something which we have stated before in our previous episodes. Even attributing the current European economic crisis to COVID-19 is a mistake. So then what is the problem, you ask? The answer may surprise you. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell confessed the West's neoliberal economic model was based on cheap energy coming from Russia, access to the big China market and low-paid Chinese workers. Europe has now lost that and is thus in crisis.
So our prosperity was based on China and Russia, energy and market. You, US, takes care of our security. You, China, and Russia provide the basis of our prosperity. This is a world that is no longer there.
What Borrell, in essence, was saying, that sustaining this capitalistic model was made possible through China's cheap labor and production with cheap energy coming from Russia. The West's economic prosperity following the end of the first Cold War in 1991 was built on a neoliberal capitalist economic model that was only made possible due to the extraction of wealth from China and Russia, the European Union's top foreign policy official Josep Borrell has confessed. Our prosperity was based on China and Russia energy and market, Borrell said. China provided the US and EU with a massive market, low-paid labor, and cheap consumer goods. And after the Soviet Union was overthrown, mass privatization in Russia and steps at integrating it into the West helped Europe secure huge amounts of inexpensive energy. The Ukraine conflict, however, has changed all of that. The EU's boycott of cheap Russian gas and oil have greatly increased the cost of living and doing business in Europe, making its products uncompetitive in global markets. This has plunged the capitalist system into a deep crisis, motivating the West, that is US and Europe, to wage a new Cold War on China and Moscow. The goal here would be to gain control over China's market and labor and Russia's natural resources. The EU's foreign policy chief acknowledged these facts in the 2022 Ambassadors Conference in Brussels on October 10th. They were reminiscent of comments made by French President Emmanuel Macron warning of what he called the end of a neoliberal era of abundance. It should be noted that Borrell is not too confident when it comes to the US. He said Europe's security policy was based on the United States and NATO, but the US is not a reliable security partner. He also said while Europe is no longer dependent on Russian energy, it is becoming dependent on US liquefied natural gas exports. This poses its own new security problem. He rounded off his speech by warning that the world is in chaos, and he named several main issues, like the NATO proxy war with Russia in Ukraine, the deep US-China competition, food and energy crises, and an impending economic recession. It is not just the proxy war in Ukraine that has destabilized Europe, Borrell said, but also the deep US-China competition. He acknowledged that the US government bears responsibility for the breakout of the war. That does it for this segment of the program. Hope you enjoyed it.
When it comes to Europe and its economies, the EU is really stuck between a rock and a hard place. I mean, it has shown that it is truly a vassal state of the U.S. in terms of the way that it's just following the U.S.'s lead. And this obviously is costing it dearly, from higher energy prices to, of course, inflation. Now, when it comes to France, the protests there that occurred, that should be a wake-up call for not only the French government, but all countries in Europe. If you recall, back in 2011, there was the Arab Spring. Are we witnessing a European spring now? Something to think about. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. From Miko Vitale and the entire team, it's goodbye until the next Economic Divide.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Rabbi habli hukman wa alhiqni bis salihin.
And he said, My Lord, grant me authority and join me with the righteous.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we reached the 83rd verse of this chapter, Surah Ash-Shu'ara, to be discussed. The verse reads, رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ. My Lord, bestow wisdom on me and join me with the righteous. Throughout the previous verses, we all understood how Prophet Abraham introduced his Lord, and he described what true Lord must be to be deserving, to be worshipped. الَّذِي خَلَقَنِي فَهُوَ يَهْدِينَ وَالَّذِي هُوَ يُطْعِمُنِي وَيَسْقِينَ. He starts with creation, guidance, feeding and providing people to drink. وَإِذَا مَرَضْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ. Such a God needs to heal you when you are sick, and He is the one who causes you to die and gives you life afterwards, and you must be having hopes on Him to forgive you your mistakes on the Day of Judgment. So, Prophet Abraham nullified the superstitious imaginations of these gods they were worshipping. And now, this verse. رَبِّ هَبْ لِي حُكْمًا. My Lord, bestow wisdom on me. The Quranic word hukm, mentioned here, can be in the sense of government, guardianship, and the management of the affairs, or it can be used with the meaning of knowledge and cognition. The word hukm, of course, has a meaning more than hikmah and wisdom and theology, because hikmah is only the power of recognition between the right and wrong, but hukm is a cognizance that is accompanied with preparation for executing the right. Anyway, from this verse on, the supplications of Abraham and his beseeching before the presence of Allah begins. رَبِّ حَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
So from this verse on, this is the supplication of Abraham before the presence of Allah. It seems that after inviting that misguided people onto Allah and stating the manifestations of His Lordship in the world of existence, Prophet Abraham becomes completely hopeless of them. He turns to the presence of Allah. He asks Him whatever He wants, so that He shows those idolaters that whatever they desire for this life, and of course the next life, they ought to ask Him. By the way, This matter is another emphasis on the absolute lordship of Allah, and this is really interesting, that by merely changing your addressee within a story, within an incident, an event, you mean something, actually, and something is implied. Prophet Abraham was describing his Lord to them, and yet he suddenly changes the addressee. He was talking to them, now he's talking to his Lord. رَبِّ حَبْ لِي حُكْمًا وَأَلْحِقْنِي بِالصَّالِحِينَ My Lord, bestow wisdom on me and join me with the righteous. When, right after he finished describing the God, وَالَّذِي أَطْمَعُ أَنْ يَغْفِرَ لِي خَطِيئَةِ يَوْمَ الدِّينَ He is the one whom I hope who will forgive me my mistakes on the Day of Judgment. And this is another aspect of the miracle of the Holy Quran. So what does he ask from his Lord? He is, in short term, asking his salvation and reaching the divine mercy. So this is what Prophet Abraham asks Allah. The cognition and inner understanding of him. Habli hukma. This is how we translate hukm in this verse. Wa alhiqni bis-salihin. Being in the presence and being accompanied with other righteous people. So in order to be successful, in order to reach salvation, it's not enough for you alone to be close to God. You need to have a society of righteous people. We'll discuss more, brothers and sisters, in the next episode, God willing. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. And my entire purpose tonight is to, especially my young guys, is to make all of you understand that what you allow to enter your thoughts, don't underestimate the power that has on you. The one control you have, I talk about this wherever I go, is the circle around you. I wish someone told me when I was 15 how dangerous and how important it is to surround me with the right people. There are some of you fathers and mothers in this audience who are obsessed with the friends of your children. Who are they? Let me meet them. How are they? What kind of family they come from? It drives the kids crazy. Mom, don't worry about it. He's my friend. No, I have to worry about it. And I ask you as parents, get involved in that process. You show me your friends, I'll show you your future. Pages upon pages of our hadith on the circle of influence, on those around you. And not just for young people. Even those of you who have family friends. There are some of you who work very hard to cultivate an Islamic identity inside of your home. Your home, mashallah, is a pious one, a God-centric one. And sometimes you place yourself with other families, travel with them, go to picnics with them, you know, have dinners with them, who are not on the same page as you. Stop and ask yourself, is that wife influencing my wife? Is he influencing my husband? Are those kids influencing my kids? Like, I remember one time, you know, we work very hard to kind of, you know, protect our kids from certain things. To the best of our ability, obviously. I remember once years ago, we went to someone's house, and the kids went upstairs in a room. They were talking, they were laughing, this and that. It was a dinner invite. This was pre-pandemic, years ago. And on the way home, you know how you kind of recap the night, right? How was the food? Too mirchi, too salty. Nice house. Did you see that kitchen? Why don't we have a kitchen like that? And then I remember my daughter had said a word. Baba, what's this? And I almost pulled over. I'm like, where'd you hear that word? She goes, oh no, the kids in the house mentioned this word. It was some artist, some singer. Who is this person? I said, Ya Allah, one night, we worked 10 years to shelter her from this one night, khalas. Don't underestimate the power of those around you. They have an amazing way of planting the seed of thought inside of you. You want to cultivate your Islamic identity? Surround yourself with the right person. If you want to cultivate an identity, marry the right person. Any one of you right now who are right now at that age in your life where you are either sending proposals or you are reviewing proposals, please, I ask you, especially my parents out there, make taqwa and piety your number one criteria. He says, when you marry for money and beauty and not for piety, eventually you lose all three. The piety was never there, the money runs out, and also so does the beauty. When you marry for piety, he says, you gain all three. With piety comes the risk of Allah. With piety comes a beauty that this fashion industry can't touch. When you fall in love with the internal kingdom of another person, your spouse, they become the most attractive person to you. But when it's all superficial after a while, and you've seen sort of their ugly side inside of them, they could be, you know, the most beautiful person to others, but to you, you can't even sit in the same room as them. I've experienced that with some couples in this city. On paper, they're like, you know, they belong on GQ magazine. Oh my God. But I can't get them to sit in one room. I don't want to see their face, Maulana. I don't want to see her face, Maulana. And flat out they say, yeah, I married him or her because of their looks. And after 6 months, 6 years even, that all fades. Identify the planters. You know this hadith that you keep hearing about, that you heard since you were a child? Where Imam Ali tells Imam Mujtaba that the heart of the youth is what? Uncultivated land. Everyone has heard that hadith, right? What will grow in there are the seeds you plant. There are multiple cultivators of your land, the land of your mind. Multiple cultivators. Identify them. Some of them you have no control over. Your parents you have no control over. Where you are raised in the city you have no control over, up until a certain age. But other ones that are influential are your spouse, are your friends, are your circle. These are absolutely cultivators. You can choose them. And the beauty of Islam is they've laid down criteria after criteria for both of them. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, one example. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. He says, do not befriend individuals who have five qualities. And by the way, this is not just for you to sit there and judge your friends. Ask yourself, am I this way for my friends? Let's turn it back onto us. The first is the kadhib, the liar. He says that this friend becomes a mirage for you. What is near, he makes far. What is far, he makes near. It's a very beautiful statement. There are some things that we would never even dream of doing. We wouldn't even think about doing. But because I have this person as a friend, he's made it possible, good or bad. And some things that are very near and dear to me. I love the center. I love coming here. I love this mosque. But he keeps planting thoughts in his head, in my head. Why do you keep going? Why do you keep going? You have to wear a mask. You have to register. Then you have to email. No. And then hit confirm. Forget it. Just stay at home. And after a while, I distance myself from the building. And one thing that I have said since we've reopened is that please give ahmiyat and importance to these four walls. Part of your identity building is found in buildings like these. We've become comfortable in our homes. Sitting in my pajamas, watching you on my device. Oh, it's great. Sayyid Hassan, we're all there now. My kids are there. My wife is there. My husband is there. No commute now. Right? No travel now. No mask now. Everything I want. It's the best of both worlds, right? Virtual and I get my knowledge. We've come a little bit now, a little bit complacent, a little bit too comfortable. The idea is now to pack up the kids, get them ready, drive towards the masjid. That drive to and from sometimes is beautiful. That's the family building. Sit on this farsh with your fellow mu'mineen and mu'minat. And like I said in the beginning, grieve for Imam Hussein as a community. Don't underestimate the power of these four walls. It's upsetting they have to show that video just to show people, look, come back to the center. It's okay. Everything is all right. We've gone through a lot of precautions. The first one is the kadhib. The second one, he says, is the foolish individual who thinks now he's actually benefiting you, but actually he's not. He himself or she herself does not make sound decisions, and now he questions everything that you do. Number three is the bakhil, the stingy one, the kanjus one you say in Urdu, the tongue dust one you say in Farsi, who will drop you at a blink of an eye for a morsel of food, the hadith says. Number four is the immoral one, no sense of morality. When you need him the most, when you need her the most, she's not there for you. He is not there for you. And finally, very interesting, he says, do not befriend the one who disrespects their parents. Beautiful. He explains each one, right? He explains this last one. If they have no hesitation disrespecting their parents, they'll disrespect you too at a drop of a hat. And there's so many several ahadiths about this. Again, look inward. Ask yourself, am I like this for my circle of friends? Do I pull them away or do I celebrate in their achievements? These are triggers of thoughts. If we want the chain of thought, the six-link chain of thought, to move in a proper direction, make sure we fix those triggers that are in our control. The second one is media. I talked about this a couple of nights ago. Be careful what we watch on these streaming devices. Now, young guys, obviously, even some of my elders, when they're 40s and 50s, they watch shows they should not be watching. Sometimes I can look at a kid, the way he walks, the language he uses, I can tell what shows he's watching. Those days of family TV shows are gone. I actually remember sitting in prime time Wednesday nights, Tuesday nights, with my father, with my mother, with my siblings, watching family comedies, sitcoms, from 8 to 8:30. Clean. He would laugh, I would laugh. It's a great half an hour time. Now I can't watch advertisements with my kids. Baba, what's that? And I just shut it off quickly. I'm old enough. I know what's right and wrong, this and that. Those are all cultivators of your thoughts. Cultivators of your identity. They have an impact on your thoughts.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
In the limelight.
Qatar spent more money on gifts and travel for British MPs than any other country last year, and this was intended to gain their backing for the Football World Cup. British MPs who received gifts later appeared to speak favourably about Qatar in parliamentary debates. We have taken a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer has more on this story. Qatar has spent more money on gifts and trips for British MPs in the past year than any other country, according to Observer analysis that reveals the Persian Gulf state's lobbying efforts ahead of November's Football World Cup. The Qatari government made gifts to members of parliament worth £251,000 in the 12 months to October of 2022, including luxury hotel stays, business class flights, and tickets to horse racing events. The value of Qatar's gifts was greater than the amount spent by the 15 other countries whose governments made donations to British MPs combined, and it was more than six times the £37,661 in gifts and hospitality given to MPs by the United Arab Emirates, the second highest foreign government donor. The gifts for the past 12 months also far outstripped those from Qatar in any other year for which records are available, revealing how authorities ramped up efforts to charm British MPs ahead of the Football World Cup. Records show MPs declared about £100,000 worth of gifts and hospitality from Qatar in the 5 years to October of 2021, but more than double that figure in the last 12 months alone. Transparency International said it was extremely concerning that British MPs were accepting thousands of pounds worth of hospitality from foreign governments with questionable human rights records, and that this could leave the door open to undue influence. There is, however, no suggestion that any British MP broke rules. In some cases, MPs who received freebies later appeared to speak favourably about Qatar in parliamentary debates, or to deflect attention away from issues that the Qatari authorities have been keen to downplay. During a debate about preparations for the World Cup earlier this month, Alan Cairns, who chairs an informal parliamentary group set up to foster good relations between the United Kingdom and Qatar, made a speech praising Qatar, including paying tribute to Qatar's response to the crisis in Afghanistan. Alan Cairns, Tory MP for the Vale of Glamorgan, initiated the debate on 20th of October and later shared videos of it on Twitter alongside a Nelson Mandela quote, "Sport has the power to change the world." Records show he received £9,300 worth of donations from the Qatari government in 2022 for a five-day trip in February of this year to meet officials alongside other members of the Qatar All-Party Parliamentary Group, and for a trip a month later to attend the Doha Forum policy event. Details of Qatar's donations were revealed through analysis of declarations in the MP's Register of Interests. The records show 34 British MPs declared 40 donations from Qatar in the year to October 2022. Of those, 22 MPs were Conservative, 7 MPs were Labour, 3 were from the Scottish Nationalist Party, and 2 were Independent. Most of the money was spent on trips to Qatar for members of the Qatar All-Party Parliamentary Group to meet ministers and government officials. During 2 trips in October of 2021 and February of 2022, British MPs travelled to Qatar to discuss issues including preparation for the World Cup, workers' rights reform and bilateral relations, as well as Qatar's humanitarian and political response to the crisis in Afghanistan. The Qatari Ministry of Foreign Affairs paid for the all-inclusive visits, typically spending £7,000 to £8,000 per person for flights, hotels and meals during a 7-day trip. A source told The Observer that British MPs on one trip were put up in a luxury hotel with vast swimming pools and travelled business class on Qatar Airways. Some MPs were taken to a camel racing event and had a private dinner with officials involved in the delivery of the FIFA World Cup. The source said Qatar's lobbying effort was slick and charming, and its goal was clear: to improve Qatar's reputation in the world. The website of UK Daily News has more on this same story. The Persian Gulf state of Qatar spent more money on gifts and travel for British MPs than any other country in the world last year. The Qatari government gave gifts worth £251,000 to British MPs in the 12 months to October of 2022, including luxury hotel stays, business class flights, and horse racing tickets. The value of Qatar's gifts was more than the amount spent by the 15 other countries whose governments had donated to British MPs, and it was more than 6 times the £37,661 in gifts and hospitality bestowed on MPs by the United Arab Emirates, the second highest foreign government donor. Qatar's Ministry of Culture and Sport, meanwhile, paid 2 British MPs to attend the Qatar-sponsored Goodwood Festival in Sussex in July of this year, transparency records show. The MPs were Sir John Whittingdale, the Conservative MP and former Culture Secretary, who took a plus one and explained the gift was worth £1,200, and Nigel Evans, the Conservative MP for the Ribble Valley. It was the third donation for Nigel Evans from Qatar in 9 months. Neither Sir John Whittingdale nor Nigel Evans responded to requests for comment. The findings will raise concerns about attempted backdoor lobbying by foreign governments in the United Kingdom. Other countries that have donated to British MPs in the last 12 months include Bahrain, Somaliland, Republic of Azerbaijan, San Marino, and Kuwait. Transparency International's Rose Whiffen said, "Too many British MPs show poor judgment when accepting gifts and from foreign governments." Rose Whiffen said, "They need to seriously consider whether it's appropriate to accept such trips, not just whether they're allowed to." Chris Bryant, a Labour MP and chair of the House of Commons Committee on Standards, has warned that Parliament is particularly vulnerable to foreign influence and said during a debate last December that we should be aware of the danger that foreign powers could lobby through the back door. Chris Bryant is one of the MPs who accepted a donation in kind from Qatar in the form of a travel allowance, but told the House of Commons in May he regretted doing so. He has advocated for US-style rules preventing members of Congress from accepting donations and gifts from foreign governments. All stays abroad are paid for by US Congress. Relations between Britain and Qatar have strengthened in recent years. In May of this year, the then Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a strategic investment partnership under which Qatar will invest in key sectors of the British economy over the next 5 years, including fintech, life sciences, and cybersecurity. Number 10 Downing Street said the deal would create new jobs in the United Kingdom and would be worth up to £10 billion. Just days later, Britain's Ministry of Defence announced that it would fund counter-terrorism training for Qatar's military ahead of the Football World Cup. Air and sea support will be provided by Britain's RAF and the Royal Navy throughout the tournament.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, brothers and sisters from all around the world, you are listening to my voice from IRIB English Radio, and today I have the honor to be the host of today's episode. I am Bita at your service, and with me I have two dear guests. Brother Ali, hello, how are you doing?
Assalamu alaikum, thank
Assalamu alaikum.
You.
Assalamu
alaikum. For inviting me, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure for me too, and Brother Amit here.
Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. So, we're going to go through our topic today. As you know, all the women around the world are somehow different and making hijab or something like that. But one of the most important signs of Islamic women and Muslims who are women is hijab. And we are known around the world by our hijab and the way we are appear in the society, actually. So, in the last episode, we talked about the obligatory hijab and why this obligation is something that we have to accept in our society. The thing is, I'm going to just elaborate it more to you and ask you, my dear brother, Amit, I want you to answer my question that is there any flexibility in the degree of your covering yourself? I mean, for example, if you go to London, if you go to New York, if you to go somewhere that there are some dressing codes that are somehow opener than what you have in your own country, in your own Islamic country, can you follow their rules you know, and at the same time have your own beliefs and have your own Islamic beliefs, actually.
You know. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think I should refer to a verse that will first destroy me and then I will fix myself in the way. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, He says, La ikraha fid din. There is no compulsion in religion. And this verse has been quoted by many of the opposition just to justify that there is no form of compulsion in religion whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a context of this verse was revealed when the Ansar, the companions of the Noble Prophet in Medina, they were forcing their kids to accept Islam. If we look at the history of Islam, the Prophet, when he migrated to Medina, mm-hmm. Those who came with him were Muhajir, they mm-hmm. were migrants, and those who were there helping the Prophet, they were considered Ansar, the helpers. The Ansar, they were very clean people, but some of their kids, of course, they did not accept Islam in the first instance, so they were forcing. This is when the ayah, La ikraha fid din, revealed. This verse was revealed. They say, look, don't force your kids, don't force anyone to the religion. Following religion, you know, accepting the religion itself. And when I mean religion, I don't mean the religion Islam versus Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean religion Islam by its extensive meaning, taslim ilallah.
Yeah.
Meaning submissive to God Almighty, right? Don't be very aggressive when it comes to, you know, putting, you know, forcing people to accept Islam, right? When the person accepts Islam, right? Now, we're not talking about a specific country, Islamic country, non-Islamic country. We're talking about a Muslim now, right? Mm-hmm. When a person accepts Islam, he accepts it with its entirety. There was a group of people when the Prophet approached them and he told them, accept the religion, and he convinced them. They went and they, you know, they had their discussion with their elders and they came back, look, we're going to accept your Islam. We're going to pray. We're going to do whatever you say. But there are three things we're not going to accept. I'm just going to say two things so that we, in the interest of time. The first one, they said, our main job is to, for example, loot the caravans who travel, right? This is the way we get money. This is the way we earn money.
Mm-hmm.
You are saying that thievery is not allowed in your religion. Exceptional. Make it exceptional for us so that we are allowed to what? Go and loot the caravans who are traveling, the trade caravans. The second one is, forgive the prayer for us. You see, we are Arabs. We are, we see ourselves as esteemed people. You're telling me to bow in front of, you know, something that we cannot see five times a day? No, forgive this from us.
Yeah.
The Prophet said, look, if you're going to accept Islam to its entirety. If you're living in a country, let me make it into a more, you know, acceptable. Yeah. Okay. If you're living in a country, if you're going to live as a citizen of that country, you have to accept all the laws of that country. You can't say, I'm going to accept, for example, the traffic laws. I'm going to accept the laws, for example, of, you know, trade. But I'm not going to accept the laws of, for example, the educational laws there.
Mm-hmm.
You're a citizen of that country. You're obliged to do that. You've, you know, kind of given your hand of allegiance to that country.
Okay, I understand it. So you're telling me that because I accept Islam, it means that I have to accept all the things that exist in this religion. So I'm going to tell you that, for example, there is someone here in an Islamic country that is not Muslim, is Christian, is, I don't know, every other religion. So why should that person make a job too?
Comes to the legislation of that country. You see, a person who is...
So you're telling me there is an obligation to have hijab here?
There is an obligation. There are two.
There is obligation.
There are two perspectives over here. The first perspective is the Islamic perspective. You, as a Muslim,
yeah.
Wherever you go, you're in Europe, you're in North America, South America, wherever you go.
Actually, that's another story I want to hear
okay.
with you.
But when it comes to, for example, the laws of the country, the legislation of the country, you're in Iran. You have to follow the dress code of Iran. Now, whether you be a Muslim or non-Muslim, this country has been developed, and the legislations of this country have been developed based on specific values. These specific values kind of conclude that the dress code of a man should be like this and a woman should be like this. Now, whatever those values are, right now, that's not your position to discuss. This is when it comes to legislation. When it comes to you as a Muslim, whether you be in Iran or you be in India, you be in China, you have to oblige yourself to the dress code that Islam, you know, prescribes for you. In addition to that, now let me ask you this question. Mm-hmm. Why in France, for example,
mm-hmm.
where they call the civilization of freedom or whatnot, why is it that women are obliged to remove their headscarf when they get to the university?
because, you know, this is, again, this obligation, you know. Actually, I think that our generation, you know, I think I'm the candidate of the new generation here. Our generation want exactly the thing you are telling me. I mean, a person who is choosing to wear hijab should be the same value, should be of the same value, should be of the same, you know, rule everything in a society as the person who choose not to wear hijab. You know, not to wear a scarf. So I think there should be a balance here. I mean, I'm not opposing hijab or something at all. I'm just telling you that, okay, if someone, for example, wants to do that, okay, do that. If you don't want to do that, don't do that. There shouldn't be any obligation. Not in that way, not in that way. You know, not, if, for example, in Islamic countries, not, for example, in France at all. I just don't accept none of them. That's it.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Yes, peace Brother and blessings
be upon the Holy Prophet Islam Muhammad and his progeny. I think a part of your question was answered in our previous session, but let's, I think, dive more into this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when you say that there should be a balance between the person who observes hijab and the person who does not like to observe hijab, actually it's as if you say that, okay, I like this law of the society and I dislike the other one. Because, again, we said that in our previous session that it is a social right for the people. For example, for me, for the other, for another person, for another brother or another sister who lives in this society, that his or her right should be observed. So this is not rationally accepted to say that, okay, I'm living in this society and the rules of this society says that you have to observe hijab and I don't want to care for that. Look, as I said earlier, some of the acts of worship, or even not even the acts of worship, some of the duties of ours are social and have some social denotation and connotation. So this social aspect of it does not let us to actually be indifferent towards that. Referring to your first question that you have been asking, that in case we are going to move to flexibility to when we are migrating or let's say moving to another area or let's say another country, I have to say that, look, when you have adapted Islam, when you have adopted Islam as a religion,
mm-hmm.
then we talked about it earlier, we cannot be again selective in it. So that's why before we move, before we migrate, there are some rules and regulations for us in Islamic laws. I don't know if you have seen them or not. Islam tells us, check if the society that you are going to migrate observes the way, I mean, lets you to observe your Islamic practices or not.
Yeah.
So before even migrating, that's why even there are a set of rules for those who have migrated from an Islamic land to an non-Islamic one, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Islam tells you, in case they are going to deprive you from your Islamic, let's say, rights, so you are not allowed to go there. You see?
So let me ask you a question here. For example, just consider that I'm a student in Iran, and I want to go abroad to study my lessons and to, you know, I don't know, improve my knowledge for my country, actually. And this is my goal. This is my intention, something like that. So I have a good intention here. And, you know, for going to that university, for example, that so-called university in another country, mm-hmm. I have to change the way I have to be. I have, you know, not to wear hijab or something like that. Mm-hmm. And here, what should I do? You know, I have a good intention, but to achieve in this intention, I have to change myself.
Look, the rules of God, the laws of God cannot be changed. I mean, that's why then it's your time to sacrifice for the sake of your religion.
But I'm sacrificing the benefit of my country, of my, I don't know, of the people. I'm going for more knowledge because, for example, my country, I don't know, the where I live is not enough for me.
Look, sister,
I want to go for something more.
Yeah, the mind that actually has legislated such a thing definitely will open some other ways for the person to find some way out of it to actually to reach to that goal and destination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that to say that 100% the thing that I'm going to find is exactly in that center of the world. This is not something.
It's not like
with regard to knowledge, if a person claims such a thing, it means that he has no idea of what knowledge and science is in today's world.
You're telling me that I have to sacrifice this opportunity because I have to be faithful to the guidelines I've accepted here.
Definitely,
you know?
Not. So, moreover, when you look at the world today, very, mm-hmm. very, very few countries are the ones that actually oblige you to, for example, not to observe Islamic rule.